Chapter 12. The Play. On the evening of the third day of the holidays, there took place our first theatrical performance. Its organization had caused endless trouble, but those who were to act had undertaken full responsibility, and the other convicts knew nothing about the show except that it was to take place. We were not even told the name of the piece. The principal concern of the actors was to obtain the largest possible number of costumes. Whenever I met Baklouchin, he snapped his fingers with satisfaction, but told me nothing. I think the governor was well disposed, but we were not certain whether he knew what was going on or not, whether he had authorized it, or whether he had determined to shut his eyes and say nothing, after assuring himself that there would be no disturbance. I fancy he must have known what was afoot, but said nothing about it for fear of worse consequences. The soldiers would give trouble, or at least get drunk, unless they had something to divert them. That was a natural conclusion. Indeed, if the convicts themselves had not organized some form of entertainment during the holidays, the authorities would have been obliged to do so. However, the governor was full of idiosyncrasies, and I may be quite wrong in assuming that he both knew and had authorized our project. A man like him must be forever interfering and disappointing others, taking something away, depriving someone of his rights. He was known far and wide as a killjoy and a martinet. It mattered nothing to the governor that his severity made the men rebellious. For such offences there were suitable punishments. There are some people who reason in this way. And the only way to deal with a rascally gang of convicts was to treat them harshly and with the full rigour of the law. An incompetent officer can never understand that to apply the law without understanding its spirit is to invite opposition. He is surprised if you tell him that, besides invoking regulations, he should display a measure of common sense. He looks upon sweet reasonableness as superfluous. To expect such a thing is, in his eyes, vexatious, intolerant. However this may be, no objection was made to the performance, and that was all the convicts hoped for. I will go so far as to say that if there were no disorders, no violence, no robberies throughout the holiday period, it was only because the prisoners were allowed to organize their own amusement. I saw with my own eyes how they avoided anyone who was drunk, and how they prevented quarrels on the grounds that their play would be forbidden. They were asked to give their word of honour that they would behave well and that all would go off quietly. They gave it with pleasure, and religiously kept that promise. They took it as a compliment that they were trusted in this way. Let me add that the show cost the authorities nothing whatsoever. The theatre could be erected and taken down within a quarter of an hour, and in case an order stopping the performance suddenly arrived, the scenery could have been put away in a few minutes. Costumes were stowed in the convicts' boxes. Let me say a word or two about the programme. There was no written playbill, not at any rate for the first performance. It was ready only for the second and third. Baklouchin composed it for the officers and other distinguished visitors who might deign to honour the performance with their presence, including the officer of the guard, the officer of the watch, and an engineer officer. It was in their honour that the thing was written out at all. It was supposed that the reputation of our theatre would extend to the whole fortress, and even to the town, for at N there was no theatre, except a few amateur performances. The convicts delighted in the smallest success, and boasted of it like children. "Who knows?" they said to one another. "When the officers hear of it, they will perhaps come and see. Then they'll realize what convicts are worth. This is no mere sketch done by soldiers, but genuine theatre, played by genuine actors. Nothing like it could be seen anywhere in the town." General Abrosimov had a show at his house, and they say he's going to have another. Well, they may beat us in the matter of costumes, but as for the dialogue, that's a very different matter. The commander-in-chief himself will perhaps hear of it, and who knows, he may come himself. There was certainly no theatre in the town, and the convicts, especially after their initial success, went so far as to imagine that they would be rewarded, and that their period of hard labour might be shortened. A moment later, they were the first to laugh at the idea. In a word, they were children, real children, at the age of 40. I knew something about the various pieces, in spite of the fact that there was as yet no bill. The title of the first was Filatka and Miroshka, Rivals. Baklouchin boasted to me at least a week before the performance that the part of Filatka, for which he had cast himself, would be played as it had never been played before, even on the St. Petersburg stage. He strutted about the barracks, puffed up with boundless self-importance. Now and again he would declaim a speech from his part, and everyone would burst out laughing, regardless of whether it was amusing or not. They laughed at the fellow's absent-mindedness. It must be admitted that the convicts as a whole were restrained and full of dignity. The only ones who showed themselves enthusiastic over Baklouchin's tirades were the young ones, who had no false modesty, or those who were as greatly respected, and whose authority was so firmly established that they were not afraid to commit themselves. The others listened in silence, without blaming or contradicting, but they did their best to show that the performance left them indifferent. It was not until the very last moment, the very day of the first performance, that all showed a genuine interest in what their companions had undertaken. "What," they asked, "will the governor say? Will the show succeed as well as that one 2 years ago?" etc., etc. Baklouchin assured me that all the actors would be quite at home on the stage, and that there would even be a curtain. Sirotkin was to play a woman's part. "You'll see how well I look in women's clothes," he said. The Lady Bountiful was to have a dress with skirts and trimmings as well as a parasol, while her husband, the Lord of the Manor, was to wear an officer's uniform with epaulettes and carry a cane. The second piece was entitled Kedril the Glutton. The title intrigued, but it was useless to ask questions. I could only learn that the piece had never been printed. It was to be acted from a manuscript copy lent by a retired non-commissioned officer in the town, who had no doubt once taken part in it on some military stage. There are indeed in the remote towns and governments a number of such pieces, which I believe are perfectly unknown and have never been printed, but which appear to have grown up of themselves in connection with the popular theatre in certain ones of Russia. Speaking of the popular theatre, it would be a good thing if students of folk literature would take the trouble to investigate its history, for it certainly exists and is perhaps not so insignificant as may be thought. I cannot believe that everything I saw on the prison stage was the work of the convicts. It must have sprung from old traditions, handed down from generation to generation, and preserved among soldiers, among workmen in industrial towns, and even among shopkeepers in some poor out-of-the-way places. These traditions have been preserved in certain villages and government towns by the servants of the large landed proprietors, whom I believe to have made numerous copies of these ancient pieces. The old Muscovite landowners and nobles had their private theatres in which their own servants used to perform. Our present-day popular theatre has developed from them, but its true origins are lost in antiquity. As for Kedril the Glutton, in spite of my lively curiosity I could learn nothing about it, except that demons appeared on the stage and carried Kedril off to hell. What did the name of Kedril signify? Why was he called Kedril and not Cyril? Was the name Russian or foreign? I could not resolve those questions. It was announced that the performance would end with a musical pantomime. All this promised to be most interesting. There were 15 actors, all intelligent fellows. They were wonderfully energetic, held several rehearsals which sometimes took place behind the barracks, kept away from the others, and gave themselves mysterious airs. They evidently wished to surprise us with something extraordinary and quite unexpected. On work days, the barracks were shut in the early evening, but an exception was made during the Christmas holidays, when we were not locked up until 9 o'clock. This favour had been granted specially in view of the play. During the whole duration of the holidays, a deputation was sent every evening to the officer of the guard, humbly requesting him to allow the performance and not to shut at the usual hour. It was pointed out that on previous nights there had been no disorderly conduct. The officer of the guard must have reasoned as follows. There was no disorder, no breach of discipline at the last performance. From the moment they give their word that at tonight's show they will be equally well behaved, they mean to act as their own police force, the most rigorous police of all. Moreover, it was certain that if he forbade the performance, these fellows, convicts are always unpredictable, might commit some offence which would place him in a very difficult position. One final reason ensured his consent. Guard duty is a wearisome job, and if he authorised the performance, he would at least see a play acted not by soldiers, but by convicts, a curious set of people. It would certainly be interesting, and he had a right to be present. If his superior officer arrived and asked for the officer of the guard, he would be told that the latter had gone to count the prisoners and close the barracks. It was a straightforward answer, which could not be disproved. That is why our masters authorised the entertainment and allowed the barracks to remain unlocked until evening throughout the Christmas holiday. The convicts already knew that they would meet with no opposition from the officer of the guard, and they gave him no trouble. Towards 6 o'clock, Petrov came to fetch me, and we went together to the theatre. Every prisoner in our barrack was there, with the exception of the old believer from Chernigov and the Poles. The latter decided not to attend until the last performance on the 4th of January, after they had been assured that there would be no unseemliness. The haughtiness of these Poles irritated the other convicts. Accordingly, they were received on the 4th of January with frigid politeness and conducted to the best places. As for the Circassians and Isaiah Fomitch, they took genuine delight in the play. Isaiah Fomitch gave 3 kopecks at each performance, except the last, when he placed 10 kopecks in the plate, and how happy he looked. The actors had decided that each spectator should give what he thought fit. The receipts were to cover expenses, and anything beyond was to go to the actors. Petrov assured me that I should be allowed to have one of the best places, however full the theatre might be, first, because being richer than the others, there was a probability of my giving more, and secondly, because I knew more about acting than anyone else. And so it turned out. But let me first describe the theatre. The barrack room of the military section, which had been turned into a theatre, was 15 feet long. From the courtyard one entered first an antechamber, and then the barrack itself. The interior, as I have already mentioned, was laid out in a peculiar manner, the beds being placed against the wall so as to leave an open space in the middle. One half of the room was reserved for the spectators, while the other, which communicated with a second building, formed the stage. What astonished me, directly I entered, was the curtain, which was about 10 feet long. It was indeed a marvel, for it was painted in oils and represented trees, tunnels, ponds, and stars. It was made of pieces of linen, old and new, shirts, bandages which the Russian peasant wears round his feet in lieu of socks, etc., etc., given by the convicts and all sewn together, well or ill, to form an immense sheet. Where there was not enough linen, it had been replaced by writing paper, gathered sheet by sheet from various office desks. Our painters, among whom was one Brulov, had painted it all over, and the effect was very remarkable. This luxurious curtain delighted even the most sombre and morose of the convicts. These, like the rest, showed themselves mere children as soon as the play began. They all felt pleased and were satisfied, not without a touch of vanity. The theatre was lighted with candle ends. 2 benches, which had been brought from the kitchen, were placed before the curtain, together with 3 or 4 large chairs borrowed from the non-commissioned officers' mess. These chairs were for the officers, should they think fit to honour the performance. As for the benches, they were for any non-commissioned officers, engineers, clerks, directors of the works, and other minor officials who might care to look in on the show. In fact, there was no lack of visitors. They came in greater or smaller numbers according to the day, but for the last performance there was not a single place unoccupied on the benches. Behind them, the convicts stood crowded together. They remained standing up out of respect to the visitors, and were dressed in their coats or short pelisses, in spite of the suffocating heat. As might have been expected, the place was too small, and the prisoners and the audience stood closely packed, especially in the last few rows. The bedsteads were all occupied, and some enthusiasts could be seen arguing in the room beyond the stage, where they viewed the performance from behind. Petrov and I were invited to stand in the front row near the benches, whence a good view could be obtained. They looked upon me as a good judge, a connoisseur, a regular playgoer. The convicts remarked that Baklouchin had often consulted me and taken my advice. Consequently, they decided that I should be treated with respect and given one of the best places. These men are vain and frivolous, but only on the surface. They laughed at me when I was at work because I was an unskilled workman. Almazov, for instance, had a right to despise us gentlemen and to boast of his superior skill in pounding alabaster. His laughter and raillery were directed against our origin, for we belonged by birth to the caste of his former masters, of whom he retained no single happy memory. But here in the theatre, these same men made way for me, for they knew that on this subject I knew more than they did. Even those who were not at all well disposed towards me were glad to hear me praise the performance, and gave way to me without the least servility. Looking back, I realize that this temporary change of heart involved no self-abasement. Rather, it implied a sense of their own dignity. The most striking characteristic of the Russians is their conscientiousness and love of justice. There is no false vanity, no sly ambition to rise without merit. Such faults are alien to our people. Take them from their rough shell, and you will perceive, if you study them closely, attentively and without prejudice, qualities which you would never have suspected. Our philosophers have very little to teach the common folk. I will go further and say that those sages might even take lessons from them. Before escorting me to the theatre, Petrov had told me in all simplicity that they would pass me to the front because they expected a handsome donation from me. There were no fixed prices for a place. Each one gave what he liked and what he could afford. Nearly everyone placed a piece of money in the plate when it was handed round. Even if they had invited me forward in the hope that I would give more than the others, was there not in that a sense of personal dignity? "You are richer than I am. Go to the front row. We are all equal here, it is true. But you pay more, and the actors prefer a spectator like you. Take first place, then, for we have no money, and must sort ourselves out anyhow." What noble pride appears in this their method! In the final analysis, it implies not love of money, but self-respect. There was little esteem for money among us. I do not remember that one of us ever lowered himself for the sake of money. Some used to fawn on me, but it was from love of cunning and of fun rather than in the hope of obtaining any benefit. I do not know whether I make myself clear. I am, in any case, forgetting the performance. Let me return to it. Before the curtain rose, the room presented a strange and animated appearance. In the first place, there was the crowd, pressed, crushed, jammed together on all sides, but impatient, full of expectation, and every face glowing with delight. At the back was a grovelling, confused mass of convicts, many of whom had brought logs of wood on which they stood leaning against the wall. They relieved the fatigue consequent on this awkward position by placing both hands upon the shoulders of their companions, who seemed quite ill at ease. Others stood on tiptoe, with their heels against the stove, and thus remained throughout the performance, supported by their neighbours. Massed against the beds was another compact crowd, for here were some of the best places of all. Five convicts had hoisted themselves to the top of the stove, whence they had a commanding view. These fortunates were extremely happy. Elsewhere swarmed the late arrivals, unable to find good places. Everyone was well-behaved and made no noise. Each man wished to show to advantage before the distinguished visitors. Simple and natural was the expression on these ruddy faces, damp with perspiration, as the rise of the curtain was eagerly awaited. What a strange look of infinite delight, of unalloyed pleasure, was painted on these scarred countenances, these branded foreheads, so dark and menacing at ordinary times. They were all without their caps, and as I looked back at them from my place, it seemed to me that their heads were entirely shaved. Suddenly, the signal is given, and the orchestra begins to play. This orchestra deserves special attention. It consisted of eight musicians, two violins, one of which was the property of a convict, while the other had been borrowed from outside, three balalaiki made by the convicts themselves, two guitars and a tambourine. The violins sighed and shrieked, and the guitars were worthless. But the balalaiki were remarkably good, and the agile fingering of the artists would have done honour to the cleverest executant. They played scarcely anything but dance tunes. At the most exciting passages, they struck with their fingers on the body of their instruments. The tone, the execution, were always original and distinctive. One of the guitarists knew his instrument thoroughly. He was the gentleman who had killed his father. As for the tambourinist, he really did wonders. Now he twirled the instrument on one finger. Now he rubbed the parchment with his thumb and brought from it a countless multitude of notes, now dull, now brilliant. At last, two mouth organs joined the orchestra. I had no idea until then of what these popular and vulgar instruments could do. I was astonished. The harmony, and above all the expression, the very conception of the motif, were admirably rendered. I then understood perfectly, and for the first time, the remarkable boldness, the striking abandonment which are expressed in our popular dance tunes and our folk songs. At last the curtain rose. Everyone stirred. Those at the back raised themselves on tiptoe. Someone tumbled off his log, and at once there were looks enjoining silence. The performance now began. I was not far from Ali, who was in the midst of a group formed by his brothers and the other Circassians. They had a passionate love of the stage and did not miss a single evening. I have noticed that all Mohammedans, Circassians and others of their kind, are fond of all kinds of theatrical performance. Near them was Isaiah Formich, almost in ecstasy. As soon as the curtain rose, he was all ears and eyes. His countenance revealed his expectation of some marvel, and I should have been sorry had he been disappointed. Ali's charming face shone with a childish joy, so pure that I was quite happy to behold it. Involuntarily, whenever a general laugh echoed an amusing remark, I turned towards him to watch his expression. He did not notice me. He was too intent upon the play. Not far to his left stood a convict, already advanced in years, sombre, discontented, and always grumbling. Yet he too had noticed Ali, and more than once I saw him cast furtive glances, so charming was the young Circassian. For some reason unknown to me, the prisoners always called him Ali Simeonich. In the first place, Filatka and Miroshka. Baklouchin, in the part of Filatka, was really marvellous. He played his role to perfection. It was obvious that he had weighed every speech and every movement. He managed to give to each word, each gesture, a meaning which agreed perfectly with the character he represented. Apart from the conscientious study he had made of the part, he was gay, simple, natural, irresistible. If you had seen Baklouchin, you would certainly have said that he was a born actor, an actor by vocation and of great talent. I have seen Filatka several times at the St. Petersburg and Moscow theatres, and I declare that none of our celebrated actors was equal to Baklouchin in this part. They were not real peasants, not true Russian mujiks, and their artificiality was all too apparent. Baklouchin was spurred by rivalry, for it was known that in the second piece Kedril would be played by a convict named Potsiakin. I do not know why, but it was assumed that he would prove more talented than Baklouchin. The latter was childishly annoyed at this supposition, and had opened his heart to me on several occasions during the last few days. 2 hours before the performance, he was in a state of feverish anxiety. But when the audience burst out laughing and shouted, "Bravo, Baklouchin, well done!" his face was radiant with joy, and real inspiration shone in his eyes. The love scene between Kiroshka and Filatka, where they kiss and Filatka tells the girl, "Wipe your mouth," and then wipes his own, was extremely amusing. It evoked loud laughter. I was particularly interested in the spectators. They were all at their ease and gave themselves up frankly to their mirth. Cries of approbation became more and more numerous. A convict would nudge his companion and make a hurried comment without even troubling to find out who was by his side. When a comic song began, one man might be seen waving his arms as if inviting his companions to laugh, after which he would suddenly turn again towards the stage. A third smacked his tongue against his palate and could not keep quiet for a moment. But as there was not room for him to change his position, he hopped first on one leg and then on the other. Towards the end of the piece, the general gaiety reached its climax. I am in no way exaggerating. Imagine the prison, the chains, the captivity, the long years of confinement, the hard labour, the monotony, falling away drop by drop like rain on an autumn day. Imagine all this despair alleviated by permission given to the convicts to amuse themselves, to breathe freely for an hour, to forget their nightmare, and to organize a play. And what a play! One that excited the envy and admiration of our town. "Fancy those convicts," people said. They were certainly interested in everything. Take the costumes, for example. You see, it would be quite an event to watch Nietsvitaev or Baklouchin in a costume so different from that which they had worn for years on end. Imagine a convict, a genuine convict, whose chains ring when he walks, and there he is, out on the stage, with a frock coat and a round hat and a cloak like any ordinary civilian. He is wearing a false moustache. He takes a red handkerchief from his pocket and shakes it like a real nobleman. What enthusiasm! The lord of the manor arrives in an aide-de-camp's uniform, a very old one, it is true, but with epaulettes and a cocked hat. The effect produced is indescribable. There had been two candidates for this costume, and, will it be believed, they had quarrelled like two little schoolboys as to which of them should play the part. Both wanted to appear in military uniform with epaulettes. The other actors separated them, and, by a majority of voices, the part was allotted to Nietsvitaev, not because he was a better actor or because he bore a greater resemblance to a nobleman, but simply because he had assured them all that he would carry a cane, and that he would twirl it and wrap it on the ground like a real nobleman, a dandy of the latest fashion, which was more than Vanka and Ospietu could do, seeing they had never met a nobleman. In fact, when Nietsvitaev appeared on the stage with his wife, he did nothing but draw circles on the floor with his light bamboo cane, evidently thinking that was a sign of good breeding, of supreme elegance. Probably in his childhood, when he still ran barefooted, he had been impressed by the skill of some landowner in twirling his cane, and this impression had remained in his memory for more than 30 years. Nietsvitaev was so engrossed in his part that he saw no one, and recited his part of the dialogue without even raising his eyes. The most important thing for him was the end of his cane and the circles he drew with it. The Lady Bountiful was also most remarkable. She came on in an old, worn-out muslin dress which looked like a rag. Her arms and neck were bare. She had a little calico cap on her head, with strings under her chin, an umbrella in one hand, and in the other a fan of coloured paper, with which she constantly fanned herself. This great lady was welcomed with a howl of laughter. She, too, was unable to restrain herself, and she burst out more than once. The part was taken by a man named Ivanov. As for Sirotkin, he looked exceedingly well dressed as a girl. The couplets were all well sung. In a word, the piece was played to the satisfaction of everyone. Not a word of hostile criticism was passed. Who, indeed, was there to criticize? The air Sieni Moi Sieni was played again by way of overture, and the curtain once more rose. Kedril the Glutton was the next piece. Kedril is a sort of Don Juan. The comparison is fair enough, for master and servant are both carried off by devils at the end of the play. So far as the convicts knew, the drama was complete, but the beginning and the end must have been lost, for it had neither head nor tail. The scene is laid in an inn somewhere in Russia. The landlord enters with a nobleman wearing a cloak and a battered round hat. The valet, Kedril, follows his master. He carries a valise and a fowl wrapped up in blue paper. He wears a short pelisse and a footman's cap. This fellow is the glutton. The part was played by Potsyakin, Baklouchin's rival, while the part of the nobleman was filled by the same Ivanov who played Lady Bountiful in the first piece. The innkeeper, Nietsvitaev, warns the nobleman that the room is haunted by demons and withdraws. The nobleman is interested and preoccupied. He murmurs aloud that he has known that for a long time, and orders Kedril to unpack his things and prepare supper. Kedril is a coward as well as a glutton. When he hears tell of devils, he turns pale and trembles like a leaf. He would like to run away, but is afraid of his master. Besides, he is hungry. He is voluptuous. He is sensual, stupid, though cunning in his way, and, as I have said, a poltroon. He is constantly cheating his master, though he fears him like fire. He belongs to a well-known type of servant, in whom may be recognized the principal characteristics of Leporello, but indistinctly and confusedly. The part was played in really superior style by Potsyakin, whose talent was beyond discussion, surpassing as it did, in my opinion, that of Baklouchin himself. But when I spoke to Baklouchin next day, I concealed my impression from him, knowing that it would cause him bitter disappointment. As for the convict who played the nobleman, he was not at all bad. Everything he said was meaningless and unlike anything I had ever heard before, but his enunciation was clear and his gestures becoming. While Kedril is busy with the valise, his master paces up and down and announces that from that day forth he means to lead a quiet life. Kedril listens, makes grimaces, and amuses the spectators with his asides. He has no pity for his master, but he has heard of devils, would like to know what they are like, and thereupon questions him. The nobleman replies that some time ago, being in danger of death, he had asked the aid of hell. The devils had come to his assistance and delivered him, but the term of his liberty has now expired, and if the devils come that evening, it will be to demand his soul, as was agreed in their compact. Kedril begins to tremble in earnest, but his master does not lose courage, and orders him to prepare supper. At mention of victuals, Kedril revives, and, taking out a bottle of wine, he marks it for his own benefit. the audience shakes with laughter. But the door grates on its hinges. The wind shakes the shutters. Kedril trembles and hastily, almost unconsciously, puts into his mouth an enormous piece of fowl, which he is unable to swallow. There is another gust of wind. "Is supper ready?" cries his master, still striding about the room. "Directly, sir. I am preparing it," says Kedril, who sits down and, taking care that his master does not see him, begins to eat the supper himself. The audience show their approval of the cunning of a servant who so cleverly makes game of a nobleman, and it must be admitted that Potsiakin, who played the part, deserved high praise. His pronunciation of the words, "Directly, sir, I am preparing it," was admirable. Kedril eats slowly, and trembles at every mouthful lest his master sees him. Every time the nobleman turns round, Kedril hides under the table, holding the fowl in his hand. When he has appeased his hunger, he begins to think of his master. "Kedril, will it soon be ready?" cries the nobleman. "It is ready now," replies Kedril boldly, when all at once he perceives that there is scarcely anything left. Nothing remains but one leg. The master, still sombre and preoccupied, notices nothing, and takes his seat while Kedril places himself behind the chair with a napkin over his arm. Every word, every gesture, every grimace from the servant as he turns towards the audience to laugh at his master's expense excites the greatest mirth among the convicts. Just at the moment, as the young nobleman begins to eat, the devils arrive. They resemble nothing human or terrestrial. A side door opens, and the phantoms appear dressed entirely in white, with lighted lanterns in lieu of heads and scythes in their hands. Why the white dress, the scythe, and the lantern? No one could tell me, and the matter did not trouble the convicts. They were sure that this was how it should be done. The master comes forward courageously to meet the apparitions, and calls out to them that he is ready and they may take him. But Kedril, as timid as a hare, hides under the table, not forgetting, in spite of his terror, to take a bottle with him. The devils disappear. Kedril comes out of his hiding place, and the master begins to eat his fowl. Three devils now re-enter and seize him. "Save me, Kedril!" he cries. But Kedril has something else to think of. He has with him in his hiding place not only the bottle, but also the plate of fowl and the bread. He is alone. The demons are far away, and his master also. Kedril emerges from beneath the table, looks around, and his face suddenly lights up. He winks like the rogue he is, sits down in his master's place, and whispers to the audience, "Now I have no master but myself." Everyone laughs at seeing him masterless, and he says, always in an undertone and with a confidential air, "The devils have carried him off." The enthusiasm of the spectators is now without limits. The last phrase was uttered with such roguery, with such a triumphant grimace, that it was impossible not to applaud. But Kedril's happiness does not last long. Hardly has he taken up the bottle of wine, poured himself out a large glass, and carried it to his lips, than the devils return, slip behind, and seize him. Kedril howls like one possessed, but he dare not turn round. He wishes to defend himself, but cannot, for in his hands he holds the bottle and the glass, from which he will not be separated. His eyes starting from his head, his mouth gaping with horror, he remains for a moment looking at the audience with a comic expression of cowardice that might have been painted. At last, he too is dragged away. His arms and legs wave in all directions, but he sticks to his bottle. He begins to shriek, and his cries can still be heard after he has been carried from the stage. The curtain falls amid general laughter, and everyone is delighted. The orchestra now attacks the famous dance tune, Kamarinskaya. First it is played softly, pianissimo, but the motive is gradually developed and played more lightly. The tempo increases, and the woodwind joins the balalaiki sound. The musicians enter thoroughly into the spirit of the dance. Glinka, who arranged Kamarinskaya in the most ingenious manner and with harmonies of his own devising for full orchestra, should have heard it as it was performed in our prison. It forms the accompaniment of the musical pantomime and is played throughout. The stage represents the interior of a hut. A miller and his wife are seated, one mending clothes, the other spinning flax. Sirotkin plays the part of the wife, and Nietzvitaev that of the husband. Our scenery was very poor, and in this piece, as in the preceding ones, imagination had to supply what was wanting. Instead of a wall at the back of the stage, there was a carpet or blanket. To the right, shabby screens. To the left, where the stage was not enclosed, the bedsteads could be seen. But the spectators were not exacting, and were well able to imagine all that lacked. It was an easy task, for all convicts are great dreamers. Directly they are told this is a garden, it is, so far as they are concerned, a garden. Informed that this is a hut, they accept the description without difficulty. To them, it is a hut. Sirotkin was charming in woman's dress. The miller finishes his work, takes his cap and whip, goes up to his wife, and gives her to understand by signs that if, during his absence, she is so foolish as to receive anyone, she will answer for it, and he shows her his whip. The wife listens and nods her head affirmatively. She has evidently had a taste of that whip. The hussy has often deserved it. Exit her husband. Hardly has he turned upon his heel than his wife shakes her fist after him. There is a knock. The door opens, and in comes a neighbour, who is also a miller by trade. He is bearded, is in a kaftan, and brings her a red handkerchief as a present. The woman smiles. Another knock is heard at the door. Where shall she hide him? She conceals him under the table and resumes her distaff. Another admirer now presents himself, a farrier in the uniform of a non-commissioned officer. Until now, the pantomime had proceeded splendidly. The gestures of the actors were beyond criticism, and it was astounding to see these amateur actors perform their parts so correctly. Involuntarily one thought, what a deal of talent is lost to Russia, left to stagnate in prisons and other places of exile. The convict who played the farrier had doubtless taken part in a performance at some provincial theatre, or had played with amateurs. It seemed to me, however, that these fellows knew nothing of acting as an art, and their movements were gauche beyond words. When it was his turn to appear, he came on like one of the classical heroes of the old repertory, taking a long stride with one foot before he raised the other from the ground, throwing back his head on his shoulders and casting proud looks around him. If such a gait was ridiculous on the part of classical heroes, still more so was it when the actor was representing a comic character. But the audience thought it quite natural, and accepted the actor's triumphant walk as a necessary fact without criticizing. A moment after the entry of the second admirer, there is yet another knock. The wife loses her head. Where is the farrier to be concealed? In the chest. Fortunately, it is open. The farrier jumps in, and the lid falls upon him. The new arrival is a Brahmin in full costume. His entry is hailed by the spectators with a roar of laughter. This character is played by the convict Kuchin, who fills the role to perfection, thanks largely to a suitable physiognomy. He explains in pantomime his love of the miller's wife, raises his hands to heaven, and then clasps them on his breast. There is now a fourth knock, a vigorous one this time. There can be no mistake. It is the master of the house. The miller's wife loses her head. The Brahmin runs about frantically, begging to be hidden. She helps him to slip behind the cupboard, begins to spin, and continues to do so without thinking to open the door. In her fright, she gets the thread twisted, drops the spindle, and, in her agitation, pretends to turn it when it is, in fact, lying on the floor. Sirotkin's representation of her alarm was perfect. Then the miller kicks open the door and approaches his wife, whip in hand. He has seen everything, for he was spying outside, and he informs his wife by signs that she has three lovers concealed in the house. He proceeds to search for them. First, he finds the neighbour, whom he drives out with his fist. The frightened farrier tries to escape. He raises the lid of the chest with his head and is immediately spotted. The miller thrashes him with his whip, and for once this gallant does not march in the classical style. The only one now remaining is the Brahmin, for whom the husband seeks for some time without finding him. He is at length discovered in his corner behind the cupboard. The miller bows to him politely, and then draws him by his beard into the middle of the stage. The Brahmin tries to defend himself and cries out, "Accursed! Accursed!" the only words pronounced throughout the pantomime. But the husband will not listen, and, after settling accounts with him, turns to his wife. Seeing that her turn has come, she throws away both the wheel and spindle and runs out, causing an earthen pot to fall as she shakes the room in her fright. The convicts burst out laughing, and Ali, without looking at me, takes my hand and calls out, "See! See the Brahmin!" He is bent double with laughter. The curtain falls, and another song begins. There were two or three more, all broadly humorous and very droll. They were not composed by the convicts, but the latter had contributed something to them. Every actor improvised to such purpose that the text was different each evening. The pantomime ended with a ballet in which there was a burial. The Brahmin went through various incantations over the corpse, and with effect. The dead man returns to life, and in their joy all present begin to dance. The Brahmin dances in Brahminical style with the dead man. That was the finale. The convicts now separated, happy, delighted, and full of praise for the actors and of gratitude towards the non-commissioned officers. There was not the least disorder, and they all went to bed with peaceful hearts to sleep a less troubled sleep than usual. This is no mere imagination on my part, but the truth, the very truth. These unhappy men had been permitted to live their own lives for a few brief hours, to amuse themselves as human beings, to escape for a short while from their miserable status as convicts, and a moral change was effected, at least temporarily. The night is now quite dark. Something makes me stir, and I awake. The old believer is still praying on top of the high porcelain stove, and he will continue so to pray until dawn. Ali is sleeping peacefully by my side. I remember that when he went to bed, he was still laughing and talking with his brothers about the theatre. Little by little, I began to remember everything. The preceding day, the holiday period, and all the month of December. Fearfully, I raise my head, and in the fitful candlelight gaze at my slumbering companions. I watch their unhappy countenances, their miserable beds. I view their nakedness, their wretchedness, and then convince myself that it is no nightmare, but simple reality. Yes, it is reality. I hear a groan. Someone has moved his arm and caused his chains to rattle. Another is troubled in his dreams and speaks aloud, while the old grandfather prays for the Orthodox Christians. I listen to his prayer, uttered regularly, and in soft, rather drawling notes. "Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on us." Well, I am not here forever, but only for a few years, I said to myself, and again laid down my head upon my pillow.